And right now, we have a special guest with us, as I introduced at the beginning of the show. With us today is Roy H. Shulman, who is a Catholic convert from Judaism and the author of the book Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming, from Ignatius Press, who was in Toronto at Convocation Hall at the University of Toronto as one of the keynote speakers at a special day organized by the Ave Maria Center in Toronto. Shulman was born in a suburb of New York City of conservative Jewish parents who had fled Nazi Germany. After a few years of working on the design of new computer systems, he went on to Harvard Business School for an MBA, and as a result of an exceptional performance there, was invited to join the faculty of the Harvard Business School at age 30. Shulman's life changed forever in 1987 while on vacation in Cape Cod. Good afternoon, Mr. Shulman, and welcome to our music program on HMWN Radio Maria in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me.
Now, I really enjoyed your wonderful discussion at Convocation Hall in Toronto over a week ago. What were your overall impressions from that event that was organized by the Ave Maria Center?
Oh, I was very impressed. I was tremendously impressed, more than anything else, by the enthusiasm and devoutness and prayerfulness and kind of joyful piety. I think there were probably somewhere between 1,200, 1,400 people there. Is very impressive.
Yes, there was a tremendous crowd there. And as I mentioned to you in my email invitation to be a special guest on HMWN Radio Maria, your book entitled Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming, was literally selling like hotcakes that morning at Convocation Hall. Obviously, that must make you, as the author, extremely happy, because you really were able to connect with that audience you spoke with that morning. Is that the kind of positive reaction to your book happening in other places where you have spoken?
Yes, and it's very gratifying. It's continually a bit of a surprise to me, the response of course that's hit very often, and where prayerful Catholics, even if they don't have any particular connection to Jews or Judaism, like a Jewish background, get very excited by the role of Judaism in Catholic salvation history, and in particular in the Second Coming. And to see that fire ignited and the enthusiasm, which, as you said, led to them, like a stampede, you know, to sell out my books, it is very gratifying, but not in a personal ego way, but just with a sense that I'm really doing something that's in the mainstream of what heaven wants.
No, you definitely are. I was having such a difficult time getting to a book. I finally ended up getting one, and I read it really in a couple of days. I probably read about 150 pages while I was drinking a coffee at one of my coffee spots where I go. Now, what inspired you to write this book?
Oh, the truth of the matter is, I'm tempted to say, you know, God inspired me. I know that sounds a little bit odd, but I entered the Catholic Church in 1992. Maybe I'll have a chance to speak a little bit about how that came about. But when I entered the church, I because of the extraordinary circumstances that led to my entry, which frankly were like a direct experience of Christ and a direct experience of Mary, I knew that there was something I was supposed to be doing, and I had a very strong sense that these graces were not given to me for no reason, but that I had a task to perform. But I didn't know what it was, and I had never written a book, and I never thought of writing a book. And for the first 10 years, I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing, and maybe I should be a priest, maybe I should be that. I looked in some religious orders, but you know, no real strong vocational call. And then about the year 2000, 2001, all these people, in particular kind of, you know, charismatically gifted, you know, priests or people like that, would occasionally say to me, Roy, you're really supposed to write a book, but I still had no idea about what or anything like that. And I would say, if God wants me to write a book, he's going to have to tell me what about, you know. And then I was driving home from Mass early one morning, and I had to pull over by the side of the road because the thoughts and the images were flooding into my mind so rapidly. I literally had to pull over by the side of the highway and, you know, scribble down some notes, and I just knew I was, you know, being given this stream of thoughts that I should sit down and write. And that was really the beginning of the book.
Now, were Catholics or Jews the intended audience you were trying to reach by writing this book?
I the enthusiastic response by Catholics, you know, by cradle Catholics, was quite a surprise to me. I imagined, first of all, I wrote the book. I never imagined I would ever get it published, much less by a press like Ignatius Press. So I felt I was just writing the book out of obedience. I used to sit there, and of course it took a long time. It took months. I'd sit there on my word processor writing, saying, you know, Lord, you know, I'm doing what you want me to do. If it never gets off my word processor, that's your business. That's not my business, you know. I'm just doing what you're asking me to do, and whether it ever becomes a book or not, you know, that's out of my hands. So I never really expected it. You know, I wasn't, in that sense, writing it really, ever really believing that it would be published. And then I kind of imagined, well, it'll be of interest, you know, to the few hundred Catholics of Jewish background around, you know, Jews who have entered the Catholic Church. As I said, I never expected Ignatius to publish it, and much less I never expected it to become Ignatius' second bestseller the year it came out. You know probably better than I do where that responsive chord is in the hearts or in the prayer life of cradle Catholics that make it feel of such significance and interest and excitement for them to connect with the relationship between Judaism and Catholicism.
Now, what is the role, and I know you've been asked this, of Judaism in salvation history?
The simple answer is that God used Judaism to bring salvation to all of mankind, that starting with the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden, God knew that at some point in the future, the second person of the Most Holy Trinity would incarnate as a human being, as a man at some future point in time. And if he were to incarnate, it would be among a particular people at a particular point in time, even in the womb of a particular virgin, that people would have to be prepared. They would have to be prepared for this greatest gift ever given to, you know, one people singled out from among all the nations of the earth, which was to bring salvation to all mankind through being the vehicle for the incarnation of God as man. And so God chose the Jewish people for various reasons and to some extent at random, separated them out from all of the other pagan people around them, gave them the divine revelation, which we know of as the Old Testament, and prepared them in purity and morality, in giving them a theological foundation and so forth, until they were ripe enough, mature enough, to be in a position for the second person of the Most Holy Trinity to incarnate, and for them to then spread that new faith to the four corners of the earth, spread the gospel to the four corners of the world. So that's basically the role of Jews and Judaism in between, one could say, the fall of man and the first coming of Christ. And then there's the very interesting question of what's the role of Judaism and Jews in salvation in between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. Now, shortly after the crucifixion, a lot of people, including some of the church fathers, thought that the Jews had exhausted their role, that they no longer had a role to play, because they had done what they were supposed to do, which was bring about the incarnation and spread the gospel. But we have an advantage that the church fathers didn't have, which is we have the last 2,000 years of history. And I think that if you look at the last 2,000 years of history, in conjunction with some hints in sacred scripture, one can see that the Jews really were also given a role to play in between the first and second coming of Christ, and in particular in the period leading up to the second coming of Christ. Should I go on?
You've described, I mean, it's a 362-page book that I would encourage everyone to get. I mean, it took me not too long to read it. But tell me, take us through what amazing event that changed your life forever in 1987, while you were on vacation in Cape Cod.
Oh, sure, I'd love to. This is basically the story of how I went from being a 30-year-old professor at Harvard Business School to being, I hope, a fervent Catholic. Anyway, I was at the time, I had fallen away from the Jewish faith I had growing up. I was essentially atheist. I was living a very conventional kind of yuppie lifestyle as a young Harvard professor. And I was actually in a tremendous inner despair because I had achieved all of these external trappings of success, and yet life had no real purpose or meaning, and there was nothing to look forward to that could give it any purpose or meaning, because it's not like I could look forward to when I grow up or when I start a career or, you know, when I become a success to give life meaning, because that had already happened and life still had no meaning. So I was kind of thrown into this existential despair, essentially. And it was in that mood. I was walking in nature early one morning, as you mentioned in the intro, on Cape Cod, and I received the greatest single gift of my life, which is I was just walking along, lost in my thoughts, from one moment to the next. I found myself very knowingly in the presence of God and seeing my life as though I were looking back on my life from after death in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant everything I would be happy about and everything that I would wish I had done differently. I saw in an instant that my two greatest regrets when I died would be all of the time and energy I wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love greater than I imagined could exist, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I realized that here all my life I had worried about my life having no meaning, when in fact it had an infinity of meaning greater than I imagined could exist, because every moment of our life contains the potential for a moral action, for good or for evil, and if we make the right choice, if we do something of merit, so to speak, in the eyes of heaven, we will benefit from that for all eternity. And likewise, if we waste that opportunity, or God forbid, do something of negative moral value, we will rue that for all eternity. I saw that here all my life I had worried about the circumstances. I would go through life in the state of remorse, saying to myself, oh, if only that disaster hadn't happened, I'd be happy, or if only that hadn't happened, I'd be happy. And I realized in this illumination that nothing could be further from the truth, that every single circumstance that had occurred in my life had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. I knew the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve him. The only thing I didn't know was who he was. And I couldn't really put him together with the God of the Old Testament that I had grown up with in Judaism. And so I prayed on the spot, let me know your name so I know what religion to follow so I can worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. I actually prayed this at the time, so he didn't reveal his name to me. But after this experience, I went back home, happy in some sense, for the first time since childhood, and every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer to know the name of my Lord and Master who had revealed himself to me that day. And a year to the day after that initial experience, I went to sleep. I felt as though I were woken by a hand gently rocking my shoulder. Now, I know it was a dream, and if there were a camera in the room, it would have shown me asleep, but the way it felt was as though I were woken by a hand on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could imagine. Just to be in the presence of the love that flowed from her was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I imagined could exist. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And she said that she would answer any questions that I had for her. So I asked her four or five questions, which she answered. And then she spoke to me for about 10 more minutes. And then the audience was over, and I went back to sleep. And the next morning, I knew it had been Christ on the beach, and I wanted nothing other than to become as fully and completely a Christian as I possibly could. I still didn't know what a Catholic was or a Protestant was. And that took me a little thrashing around and a year or two to figure out. But I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, so I didn't go too far down any detours.
Of course, she's the Queen of Heaven, of all the angels and saints. And I'd like to just take a quick break, Roy, and just go to a song that I've chosen actually right now, quite appropriately, Queen of Heaven by Mark Mallett. And this is from Mark's Song for Carol CD. Here's Queen of Heaven on HMWN Radio Maria, the gift of God's presence in your home. That was singer-songwriter Mark Mallett singing Queen of Heaven from his Song for Carol CD, which is a tribute to Pope John Paul II. And we're back with Roy H. Shulman, who's here live on our program via telephone. And you were baptized and confirmed into the Catholic Church in 1992. What made you decide to convert to the Catholic Church?
Well, as I mentioned, I had that dream experience of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And in the course of that experience, I knew who she was. In other words, I don't know what the right word is, but I knew how exalted she was. I knew how major she was in the story of man and God. I can mention two things, or maybe three things, that made that very clear to me. The first is that when I found myself in her presence, I was just overwhelmed with a desire to somehow reverence her or honor her. What I really wanted to do was throw myself on my knees or even throw myself prostrate and reverence her, maybe even worship her. Now, I know that's not appropriate. But we know from both the Old and New Testament that whenever a mere mortal found themselves in the presence of an angel, right? You know, this from St. John in his New Testament scriptures, when he found himself in the presence of an angel, he threw himself prostrate and began to worship the angel until the angel said, "No, don't do that. Get up. That's not appropriate. I'm only a creature." And we know that the Blessed Virgin Mary is the queen of the angels, that she's more exalted than the highest of the angels. So, you know, of course, finding myself in her presence, I was just overwhelmed by her grandeur. And in fact, one of the questions that I asked her out of this state of being stupefied by finding myself in the presence of such glory was, I kind of stammered out to her, "How can this be? How can it be that you're so magnificent, that you're so exalted?" And she just looked at me kind of pityingly and shook her head gently and said, "Oh no, you don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created thing. He's everything." So I learned two things at the same time. I learned, of course, her humility and the correct position that all of us creatures are with respect to God. But I also learned that she was far more exalted than any other creature. So even though the next morning when I woke up, I didn't know what a Catholic was or a Protestant was, and I started going to a Protestant church, I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, so I could never be satisfied in a Protestant environment where they didn't reference the Blessed Virgin Mary. And the other thing that happened was I was spending all my free time at Marian shrines just to feel the presence of Mary. And, of course, Marian shrines are generally Catholic, and very often there would be a Mass going on. And whenever I was present at a Mass going on, I was filled with a tremendous, almost greedy desire to receive communion. And so, basically, between knowing who the Blessed Virgin Mary was and wanting to receive communion every day if possible, that kind of served as the compass that guided me to the Catholic Church.
Now, what was the reaction of your parents, Roy, to your conversion to the Catholic Church?
I sometimes say, half in jest, that they were fine for the first 3 years because I didn't tell them. It took me about 2 or 3 years to screw up the courage to tell them. And when I did tell them, they were initially extremely upset and disappointed, and in particular my father. A very typical reaction in Jewish families, especially families, is to actually consider that the child has died, maybe even have a kind of type of a funeral service for the child, and consider them dead. And my parents didn't go quite that far, but they did basically never want to have anything to do with me again. But that didn't last too long. That only lasted about 6 months. And, then the initial kind of fury of their reaction slowly subsided, and, you know, their parental love and affection crept back in. And so I would say within 2 years after the after I told them, the relationship was actually better than it had ever been, because I was so much better able to love than I had been before I had this in my heart. And they couldn't help but feel that love and respond to it.
Now, from your mentors and the rabbis under whom you studied, what was their reaction?
Well, they didn't have the parental love to fall back on. So,
no, they didn't.
So there, in particular, my hometown rabbi growing up, I was his disciple, and he was mentoring me, and he had chosen me actually to be his son-in-law. He had a daughter a year younger than me. And he was very upset. And in fact, it was his upset that brought my parents back to my side, because what happened was he ran into my parents in a local restaurant and had a temper tantrum at them and started, you know, shouting, you know, four-letter words, not literally four-letter words, but vulgar words, and, you know, accusing me, their son, of all kinds of terrible things, and, you know, oh, your son, the so-and-so, such-and-such, you did such-and-such. And he actually made quite a scene and, you know, became very red in the face and so forth. And that temper tantrum of his actually is what turned my parents around, because, first of all, their parental protectiveness of me as their child kicked into play, and they also saw the incipient insanity of that response. So they actually decided to side with me after that, so to speak. And so I'm actually very grateful to him for that.
See, God does work in mysterious ways, doesn't
he? That's right. That was providential, no question.
Yes. In one of your interviews, you consider the Lehman Brothers the patron saints of your book. How so? And tell us a little bit about these two extraordinary twin brothers who converted to the Catholic Church from Judaism as well.
Yeah, they really are heroes of mine. Let me just, I do want to go into that. Let me just say, because these stories of Jewish conversions can be very interesting and very edifying and very heartwarming, I did come out with a second book just a month or two ago called Honey from the Rock, which is also put out by Ignatius Press, which is 16 witness testimonies of Jews who entered the Catholic Church. But let me go on to the Lehman Brothers. The Lehman Brothers were orphaned twin brothers in Lyon, France, in the middle of the 19th century. They were raised by an uncle and aunt because they had lost their parents at an early age. When they were adolescents, were moved by the truth and beauty of the Catholic Church and went to a priest for instruction and realized that the Catholic faith was the truth and, in fact, was the continuation of Judaism, was the real Judaism. And so as soon as they reached the age of majority, 18, they were baptized. In fact, it was the priest who made them wait until they were 18 before he would baptize them, because he wanted to respect their, you know, family. But their uncle and aunt found out about the fact that they were baptized and got extremely angry. In fact, an uncle tried to kill them. And one uncle was holding one pinned down while the another uncle was strangling the other one of the twins. When the one who was pinned down broke free enough to run to the window and scream for help, and there were some policemen on the corner who came and broke it up. And it became a big scandal because they were, you know, one of the wealthy and notable families in the town. And the boys actually had to flee for their own safety. But they became priests together. They were actually kind of taken under the wing by another Jewish convert, actually two brother Jewish converts, Alphonse and Theodore Ratisbon, who were in Paris at the time, didn't baptize them because they were already baptized, but kind of guided their development. They became priests together. They became canons of the church together. They spent their life in a beautiful apostolate between them. They wrote, I think, at least 150 books. And started orphanages and started a community in the Holy Land to pray for the conversion of the Jews and so forth. And they were very active at the First Vatican Council. They were close friends with Pius IX. And they actually circulated a petition at the First Vatican Council that was signed by virtually all of the Council Fathers and heartily endorsed by Pius IX. And this petition was nothing more than a very warm and paternal invitation on the part of the Catholic Church to the Jews to whom they owed Christ for them to enter the Catholic Church.
Now, the New Testament is the fulfillment of the Old Testament, and in both Judaism and Christianity, the teaching and revelations about the role of faithful remnants has continued, that for the sake of just a few faithful souls, entire countries or even the entire world are spared divine justice, and is frequently reflected in private revelations made to Christian saints. And you touched upon this in your book. Could you give just a few examples in the Bible where this is true?
Well, the first example that comes to mind is Sodom and Gomorrah, where God tells Abraham that he's going to destroy Sodom, and Abraham says, if you could find 50 righteous men in Sodom, surely you wouldn't destroy them, you know, just because of all the bad ones. And Abraham negotiates God down to the point where God agrees that if there are only 10 righteous men in Sodom, he won't destroy it. Unfortunately, there weren't, so Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. But that's the first, that's not the first one. Literally, I suppose the first example is Noah, because at the time of Noah, God was disgusted with mankind and was tempted to, give up on the experiment and eradicate mankind. And in some sense, he spared all of mankind because of Noah found favor in the eyes of God. And it goes on with when Moses was leading the exodus of the Jews out of Egypt and crossing the desert, and the Jews were in a state of continual grumbling and rebellion against God. God said to Moses, you know, I've had enough of this people. Let me wipe them out. And it was Moses' personal intervention and for his sake that God spared all of the Jewish people. And in recent times, we have, for instance, the revelations to Saint Faustina, the Polish nun who lived around the time of the World War II, where Jesus explicitly says to her that essentially, you know, for her sake, he is sparing her entire country what it would otherwise receive.
Yes, and we're going to have the Divine Mercy Chaplet right after this program, Roy. Now, there was a report a few days ago about the Anti-Defamation League in the U.S. urging Pope Benedict the 16th to suspend the sainthood process for Pope Pius the 12th, whom critics accuse of turning a blind eye to the death of Jews during World War II. Nothing is further from the truth, because Pope Pius the 12th, through the Catholic Church with its religious orders, monasteries, priests, and nuns, actually helped save tens of thousands of Jews, as you quite accurately state in your book. How did this misinformation campaign against Pope Pius the 12th and the Catholic Church get started?
I think historically it appears that it actually got started by the communist government of Russia, when that plague called the Deputy came out in, I think it was the late 60s, it now turns out that the playwright behind that play seems to have been kind of directed by Russia to calumnize Pius the 12th. But it took on a life of its own, and there is a there kind of like two sides to contemporary Judaism. There's the real religious side, the really good side, which is the holiness and love of God that brought about the coming of the Messiah, and that's still reflected in the religion and the people. But there's another side too, which is a tremendous resistance to the threat, the perceived threat of Christianity, a tremendous resistance to conversion, a sense of, like, we have to defend ourselves and counterattack against Christianity, because the worst thing in the world would be if, essentially, you know, Jews came to Jesus and became Christian. So there is a little bit of an institutional existence of institutions within Judaism or among Jews that really exist for the sake of holding Christianity at bay. And I think to some extent you see that reflected in the calumnies against Pius the 12th, which are coming from Jewish sources like the Anti-Defamation League. I actually think it's not founded as much on a genuine opinion of Pius XII, because, I mean, Golda Meir, you know, the first leader of the State of Israel, praised Pius XII to the skies for his intervention, what he did to save Jews. An early cabinet minister of Israel, Pinchas Lapida, wrote a book in which he said that by his estimates, Pius XII personally was responsible for saving 780,000 Jewish lives. Albert Einstein, after the war, who was, of course, a very high-profile Jew, said publicly that it was the church, the Catholic Church, was the only institution that stood up for the Jews during the Holocaust. So, I mean, this is known. So there's really something else going on, which is a desire among, I hate to admit this, but a desire among some Jewish institutions to put as much distance as possible between Christianity and Judaism, just to avoid the possibility of missionary activity or evangelization of Jews. That's a tragedy in my heart.
I just want you to touch on the remarkable conversion to the Catholic Church of Rabbi Zolli, the chief rabbi of Rome, and how he confirmed how much Pope Pius XII did to help Jews escape the Nazi concentration camps by the tens and tens of thousands, as you mentioned.
Absolutely true. His name at the time was Israel Zolli. He was the chief rabbi of Rome when the Nazis occupied Rome. The SS leader went to the Jewish community and said, unless you give us 50 kilograms of gold within 48 hours, we will have all of the Jews of Rome deported to the concentration camps. Rabbi Zolli tried to raise as much gold as he could from the Jewish community, but fell far short of the 50 kilos. He went to Pope Pius XII. And Pius XII immediately said, whatever shortfall you have, the Vatican will make up and ransom the Jews from deportation. Pius XII became a close friend of Rabbi Zolli. Rabbi Zolli converted to the Catholic faith at the end of the war, but his conversion was not out of loyalty to Pius XII per se. It was a genuine conversion. He received the grace of recognizing who Jesus was, which is the Jewish Messiah. In fact, the story is very beautiful. He was up on the dais of the main synagogue in Rome celebrating the high holiday services when he had a vision of Jesus coming towards him and saying to him, you know, this is the last time you'll be, you know, doing this. Come and follow me. And he basically immediately did that and laid down his entire career and profession and became a fervent Catholic. And that was, of course, a genuine conversion of grace. But he chose the baptismal name Eugenio precisely to honor Pius XII, whose baptismal name was Eugenio, you know, in gratitude for everything that Pius XII had done to save Jews. There's a sister, Margherita Marchione, who's a Filippini sister in the United States, has written a number of books, including this beautiful book called Yours is a Precious Witness, where she just collected witness testimonies of dozens, if not hundreds, of Jews whose lives were saved by the personal intervention of Pius XII. Pius XII ordered all of the convents and monasteries to suspend their rules of cloister so that they could allow Jews in and hide them behind the cloistered walls, which is, of course, a complete violation of, you know, the monastic, you know, rule. And he ordered the convents and monasteries to do that, to save as many Jews as possible. I think at one time there were over 400 Jews hiding out in the Vatican itself, pretending to be, you know, Swiss guards and Vatican employees and so forth.
Then, of course, I just want one more amazing story of Jewish convert Edith Stein, St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, who was a scholar, feminist, and eventually became a saint after her death. Edith Stein was a Carmelite nun of Jewish descent who was among the people gassed in a little white cottage at Auschwitz, who, although she converted to the Catholic Church, refused to renounce her Jewish faith, and then was gassed and buried in a mass grave. Later in the year, her body, like the others, was exhumed and cremated. And I've read her story, and I was deeply, deeply touched by Edith Stein.
Absolutely, and she's unique in that, I mean, just like me, just like every other Jew that I know of who's become Catholic, we don't think we're any less Jewish than we ever were. we think we're more Jewish than we ever were, if anything, right? Because the only difference between me now and me 40 years ago is that now I know that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, and I have become a Jew who is following the Jewish Messiah in the sacramental system that the Jewish Messiah established on earth to live on after his crucifixion, rather than, you know, thinking that the Jewish Messiah has not yet come, but I'm as much Jewish as ever. And Edith Stein felt the same way. And the last recorded words that she said were to her sister when they were both being taken by the Gestapo and, you know, put in a van for the concentration camp. She said, "Come, let us go for our people." She said very beautiful things where she said that because she was both a Jew and a Catholic and she understood the redemptive value of suffering, she had to go and suffer with her people and be, undergo the Holocaust so that she could unite her suffering with the suffering of all those other Jews and bring it to the foot of the cross, because the other Jews didn't know enough to bring it to the foot of the cross.
Now, you also write in your book that almost every Jew, and you kind of touched upon this in this past answer, who enters the Catholic Church feels deeply the sense of return that St. Paul captures in his image of the olive branch being grafted back onto its original natural root, that they are in no way leaving Judaism, but rather coming into its fullness. Jesus Christ himself prophesies the conversion of the Jews prior to the second coming, saying, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, behold, your house is forsaken desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." How are the Jews involved in the second coming? Now, that's a $64,000 question.
And to get to answer in 64 seconds, right? Sure, I love nothing more. I think I can do it in probably 3 or 4 minutes. St. Paul says in Romans 11 that, it's easy to think that the Jews failed to recognize Christ just because of their stubbornness, but in fact, Romans 11 says, quote, "God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved." The suggestion is that, as a matter of fact, Paul goes on then, and he says, "Have they stumbled so as to fall? By no means. Through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous." So what St. Paul is saying is, look, if the Jews had accepted Christ when he came, salvation wouldn't have come to the Gentiles. You know, Christianity would have looked like it belonged to the Jews, that it was only for the Jews. It would have been very hard to spread throughout the whole world. You see this in the book of Acts, if you look at the book of Acts, that, you know, the big problem in the early days of the church was, is Christianity only for Jews or is it for Gentiles also? This was avoided by the fact that the Jews did not recognize Christ. That enabled Christianity to spread to the Gentiles. But then, as Paul said, until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. And that says that when the full number of the Gentiles come in, then the veil will be lifted from the eyes of the Jews, and they too will be able to recognize Christ. Jesus said this in the quote that you said, and I think it's unspeakably beautiful that it's almost like the wave after wave of salvation history, and the first wave of salvation history was through the Jews, and the next wave of salvation history was through the Gentiles, for all of the Gentiles come into the church. And then the last wave of salvation history will be when the Jews too come into the church, and then the church will be complete, and that will make the world ready for the second coming. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 674, says, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." So, it seems like that's what ties up the passage and makes way for the second coming.
And it's a beautiful future, even though today at times we think everything is so bleak and dark. But we know that Jesus conquered death at the crucifixion, and our sins were forgiven as well. So we know we have a beautiful future in eternity with God forever and ever. Roy, thank you so much for sharing this hour with our listeners here on HMWN Radio Maria in Canada. And for those listening to this program, could you give your website where people can find out more about you?
I'd love to. My website is www.salvationisfromthejews.com, and there's plenty of information on the website about the books, about my conversion story. There's even the audio from that Toronto conference talk of last Saturday. It's already up there on the website. People can listen to it for free. And I'm here to spread the message and to encourage Catholics to appreciate what they were given. Us Jews have to work a little harder to get to the truth of the Catholic Church. You know, many of you were given it, you know, at your mother's knees, and it was such an infinite gift that sometimes it's hard to be aware of. So I want nothing more than to, encourage Jews to recognize the Jewish Messiah and encourage Catholics to recognize the diamond mine that they were given at birth.
Well, thank you so much, Roy Shulman. And, of course, you really made my day today, and I know you made the day of all our listeners, your conversion story and your wonderful book, Salvation is from the Jews, The Role of Judaism in Salvation History from Abraham to the Second Coming, from Ignatius Press. And God bless you, Roy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Anyways, on behalf of Tony Jan Antonio and myself, Frank Ruffalo, I'd like to bid you all a good day. God bless each and every one of you. And as always, HMWN Radio Maria is our Blessed Mother Mary's radio station, who always holds you in her arms and brings you to her Son, Jesus Christ. Have a great day. God bless you.